Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Wednesday, March 8th. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, Opinion. City's strong financial position requires planning. By Mayor Lori Merritt Blong. This Friday, the Midland City Council will hold a full-day retreat with city staff. The purpose of this retreat is to set the priorities for the upcoming budget cycle, as well as for the future of Midland. The full-day session takes us out of the normal cycle of council meetings in which we manage and approve day-to-day business for Midland and allows us to more deeply consider the short and long-term needs of our community to ensure that we are wisely stewarding taxpayer dollars. The timing of this retreat is important here in the springtime to allow senior city staff a period of a few months to prepare for next year's fiscal budget season this summer, with a clear picture of how the council intends to allocate city dollars. We will discuss future goals and priorities for Midland, and then we'll lay out a big picture pathway of how we will accomplish those goals in light of our current position. Here are a few details of our current reality in Midland. The city of Midland is in a strong financial position, thanks to conservative councils and good local economic growth over the past few years. We have a larger than average general fund balance, and we are also AAA bond rated. The state of Texas is also paying attention to our region and is making investments in our roadways and infrastructure, as well as our regional healthcare systems. Thankfully, there seems to be a renewed awareness that the region which fuels our state economy through oil and gas severance taxes deserves reinvestment from Austin. Local oil and gas revenues and sales tax collections are at an all-time high in Midland today, largely driven by increased oil field activity and the associated booming economy. These revenues are exceeding our budget expectations for fiscal year 2023 by about 21%, which obviously positions us well as we head into the next fiscal year. I view the budget of the City of Midland like a three-legged stool, with each leg representing a main revenue source that funds our city. Each leg is absolutely critical to support the balance of our budget. Those three legs are 1. Ad valorem taxes, property taxes, 2. Sales taxes, and 3. Enterprise revenues, fees associated with water bills and other city services. In this boomtime economy, the revenues of legs 2 and 3 are far outpacing the growth of leg 1. Which can make the stability of our three-legged stool a bit wonky if we aren't careful. Midland's budgeted ad valorem collection for fiscal year 2023 is $55,227,298, which sounds like a huge number until you consider the fact that our general budget is $148,550,541. The current reality is that ad valorem tax collections do not even cover police and fire department annual budgets of $38,974,564 and $38,309,472, respectively. Much less keep up with year-over-year growth of all our city services. Ad valorem collections from our residential and commercial properties, including oil and gas minerals, really are the short leg of the budget stool in Midland today, and we are thankful for the other two strong legs. So, with this current reality in mind, where do we go from here? Council will discuss and decide that together on Friday. I want to offer a few of my priorities as mayor. 1. Let's prioritize keeping a healthy fund balance and a AAA bond rating. Now is not the time to go crazy with spending just because we have cash on hand. We are blessed to be able to plan well for the future when we know we will need to make large investments in water infrastructure and other projects. He who has the water in West Texas makes the rules. And this council is committed to securing long-term water solutions for our city. 2. Let's use some of our fund balance and higher than normal sales tax revenues to invest into capital improvements of some neglected city facilities. Examples of potential projects could be the joint training facility for the police and fire departments, or improvements to our city health department or senior centers, all of which are currently in poor condition. The council will discuss these and other options on Friday to select what most benefits citizens. 3. Let's continue to allocate oil and gas revenues to parks capital improvements for the benefit of our entire community's current quality of life. 4. Let's consider the future obligations of Midland, fireman pension fund, personnel, facilities, and infrastructure maintenance, etc., as we steward the spending of our fund balance. Midland has an opportunity to make much-needed capital improvements in our community today, but we must be careful to keep our general budget spending in check. We want to build a three-legged stool which is stable and sustainable for future generations of Midland. I'm looking forward to our council retreat on Friday, and I'm so thankful we are in such a healthy financial position to plan well for the future. Midland is absolutely worth our prudent investment. This article is entitled MC's Pre-K Academy to Prepare Young Students for MISD by Ben Schaffer. Midland College's Pre-K Academy prepares children for success when they move on to Midland ISD schools. The Pre-K Academy at the college has been open for 4 years. This week, Adolfson and Peterson, the construction company in charge of the academy's expansion to a 60,000-square-foot building, announced it reached the midpoint in construction and renovation. The college plans to expand the number of seats from around 70 to nearly 300 with the expanded facility. The second floor of the new building will house Midland College's new bachelor's program in education, while the first floor will offer more pre-K classrooms. Lead gifts of $10 million each for the Midland College Pre-K Academy and Center for Teaching Excellence came from Permian Strategic Partnership and Scarborough Foundation, Inc. Other major donors include Abel Hanger Foundation, the Beale Foundation, Henry Foundation, and Warren Charitable Foundation. For a list of project donors, please visit www.midland.edu/groundbreaking. Generous donors from the Midland community played a substantial role in gathering funding for the expansion, according to Early Childhood Education Executive Director Leslie Goodrum. The college's Pre-K Academy staff works closely with the MISD Early Childhood Education Director to make sure the young students are equipped with the knowledge that will coincide with curriculum being taught at district schools, according to Goodrum. Midland College is currently in the process of hiring additional certified teachers, teaching assistants, and floater positions. We're going to need more hands on deck to serve 296 kiddos, Goodrum said. The certified teacher position on Midland College's job openings page has 12 vacancies available for the academy. There are 15 teaching assistant positions yet to be filled. certified teacher openings can be found at midland.peopleadmin.com/postings. The new classrooms and expansion should be completed by August and used for next school year, according to the college. This article is entitled, DPS Names Odessa Sex Offender, March's Featured Fugitive, by Mercedes Cordero. An Odessa man on the Department of Public Safety's Texas 10 Most Wanted Sex Offenders list has been named March's Featured Fugitive. Texas Crime Stoppers has also increased the cash reward of up to $4,000 for any information that leads to Solomon Olivas Marquez's arrest in the month of March. Marquez, 59, is wanted for failure to comply with sex offender registration requirements with a previous conviction. Marquez, who has ties to the Midland-Odessa area, is a convicted sex offender required to register annually, according to the DPS bulletin. Marquez was convicted in 2002 of aggravated sexual assault of a child after an incident involving a six-year-old girl and was sentenced to 5 years of confinement. In 2010, he was convicted of failure to comply with sex offender registration requirements and sentenced to 3 years of confinement and 3 years of probation. The Ector County Sheriff's Office issued a warrant on March 31, 2022, for his arrest for failure to comply with sex offender registration requirements with a previous conviction. To be eligible for the reward in the case, tipsters must provide information to authorities using one of the following methods. Call the Texas Crime Stoppers hotline at 1-800-252-TIPS 8477. Submit a web tip through the Texas 10 Most Wanted website or Facebook page. Submit a tip through the DPS mobile app. This article is entitled MPD, Man Charged with 2 Counts of Sexual Abuse of a Child, by Mercedes Cordero. A 28-year-old man was arrested on February 28th after a child made an outcry of sexual assault against him, according to court documents. Mark Anthony Vella was being held Tuesday in Midland County Jail on 2 first-degree felony charges of aggravated sexual assault of a child and continuous sexual abuse of a child under the age of 14. Vella's bond was set at a total of $300,000. A Midland police detective was contacted in reference to a child making an outcry of sexual assault at her school. The child stated Vella had been inappropriately touching her private parts, according to the arrest affidavit. The child was transported to the Children's Advocacy Center, where a forensic interview was conducted. During the interview, the child stated she was around 6 years old when Vella first started to abuse her. The abuse continued for the last 4 years, according to the arrest affidavit. This article is entitled, Crime Stoppers Offering Reward for Information on Missing Odessa Infant, by Mercedes Cordero. Midland Crime Stoppers and the Midland County Sheriff's Office have joined the efforts to find a missing 6-month-old Odessa infant who was last seen on January 11th. On January 12th, the Texas Department of Family and Protective Services, CPS, contacted the MCSO in reference to attempting to locate a missing child. According to a Midland Crime Stoppers Facebook post, CPS stated that on January 12th, it was given temporary custody by the state of Texas for Danny Ray Wayne Couch. CPS attempted to locate Danny Ray's biological mother, Shallon Corrali, 38, and him at their listed residence. Midland County investigators have made several attempts to locate Corrali without success at this time, the Facebook post stated. A criminal warrant for Corrali was issued on February 15th for the felony offense of interfering with child custody. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children shared an urgent alert for Danny Ray on February 27th on their social media sites. If you have any information on this case that leads to the arrest of Corrali and the whereabouts of Danny Ray, you will be eligible for a cash reward of up to $1,000. Call Midland Crime Stoppers at 694-TIPS or download the Crime Stoppers app, P3 Tips, and submit an anonymous mobile tip. No caller ID is ever used, and those providing information will remain anonymous. This article is entitled USGS, Another Quake Happens Around Midland, by Stuart Doreen. A second earthquake took place around Midland in as many days, according to the U.S. Geological Survey. The USGS reported that a 2.8 magnitude quake happened around 22.2 miles north of Midland at 8:15 a.m. Tuesday. The quake happened at a depth of 5.6 miles. Monday's quake took place around 2.5 miles southwest of Midland. The quake was the sixth around Midland in the last week, the 26th in the past 30 days, and 193rd in the past 365 days, according to EarthquakeTrack.com. The same website showed five quakes took place Tuesday around Mentone in far west Texas. EarthquakeTrack.com also reported 50 quakes in the last 7 days, 212 earthquakes in the past 30 days, and 2,090 in the past 365 days. The strongest of the five quakes near Mentone on Tuesday was magnitude 3.6. This is the obituary column. Wednesday, March 8th. Dan Rabbit Ledbetter, November 19, 1946 to March 3, 2023. Dan Rabbit Ledbetter, 76, passed away on March 3rd in Midland. Dan was born in Monahans to Elsie Ledbetter and Eva Grace Watson Ledbetter on November 19, 1946. Dan is survived by his wife Lana Ledbetter, sons Larry Ledbetter, Ladin Ledbetter, stepsons Jory Lynch and Jeremy McIntyre, 10 grandchildren, sister-in-law Paula Ledbetter, nieces Hallie and Emmy and their spouses. A celebration of life service will be held at 4 p.m. on Thursday, March 9th at Willowbrook Funeral Home Chapel, with Reverend Robert Frazier and Hilario Fuentes officiating. Services are entrusted to Willowbrook Funeral Home and Cremation Services of Midland. To place online condolences, please visit www.willowbrk.com. David Cavanaugh Sachs. David Cavanaugh Sachs passed away in the early morning hours on March 5th at the age of 64. David was born on October 14, 1958. He was adopted by Dick Sachs Jr. and Mary Virginia Sachs shortly after birth. David is predeceased by his parents, Richard Dick Baxter Sachs Jr. and Mary Virginia Sachs. He is survived by his wife, Victoria Vicky Sachs, his sister, Claudia Sachs, Michael Hale, his stepdaughter, Jessie Medlin, and her husband, Christopher, and their daughters, Jaden and Emma, his sister-in-law, Rainey Walker, his nephew and niece, Miles Walker, Katie, and Madeline Walker, sister-in-law, Christy LeHue, and his father-in-law, Rayford Calhoun. Funeral services for David will be held at 2 p.m. on Friday, March 10th, at the Episcopal Church of the Holy Trinity in Midland. A reception and celebration of his life will be held at the Petroleum Club immediately following. The family invites anyone who knew David and would love to hear your stories. In lieu of flowers, please consider memorial donations to the Episcopal Church of the Holy Trinity, Grand Companions Humane Society of Fort Davis, or Helping Hands of Midland. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Wells Funeral Home, and online condolences can be made at www.npwelch.com. Patricia Lynn Hythe Phillips. Patricia Lynn Hythe Phillips was born on March 23, 1948, to the late R.L. Hythe and Patricia Dolores Hythe in Big Spring. She passed away at home on Saturday, March 4th, surrounded by her family. She is survived by her mother, Patricia Dolores Hythe, husband Perry Phillips, son Robbie Phillips, daughter Jody Tidwell, and husband Brandon Tidwell of Lubbock. She adored and cherished every moment with grandchildren Logan Tidwell and Madeline Tidwell of Lubbock. She is also survived by sister Ann McCann and husband Tommy of Lakeway, Texas, and brother Bobby Hythe and wife Jill of Buda, Texas. The family will receive guests from 5 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, March 8th at Nally Pickle and Wells Funeral Home. Memorial service will be held at 2 p.m. Thursday, March 9th at Nally Pickle and Welsh Funeral Home Chapel. Charitable donations can be made to the American Cancer Society. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Phyllis Davis Lewis. The family of Mrs. Philip Davis Lewis sadly announced her passing on Saturday, March 4th in Houston. Phyllis, who was lovingly known as Doll, was born in Midland on May 23, 1960, to Nathaniel and Albertha Davis. Phyllis is survived by her husband, Larry E. Lewis, her daughters, Chloe L. Lewis and Candace C. Lewis of Austin, her sisters, Dorinda Lewis, Terry of Ontario, California, Deborah Davis of Stillwater, Oklahoma, and Helen Price of Midland, and her brothers, Gary Davis of North Las Vegas, Nevada, Johnny Davis of Magnolia, Texas, and Bill Woodard Maxine of Houston. Phyllis is preceded in death by her parents, her sister Esther Davis, and her brother Russell Price. The family will receive guests from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. Friday, March 10th at Nally Pickle and Wells Funeral Home. Phyllis's life will be celebrated at a service on Saturday, March 11th at 11 a.m. at Mid-Cities Church in Midland. The family suggests memorials be donated to the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. Online condolences can be made at www.npwelch.com. Death Notices. Michael Lauderdale. Michael Lauderdale, 77, of Midland, passed away March 4th. His family will schedule services at a later date. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welsh Funeral Home, and online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com.
This is Thoris with the Odessa American newspaper for Wednesday, March the 8th. Headlines: Rangers AG will not investigate Irvin. The Texas Rangers won't be investigating Ector County Utility Board President Tommy Irvin and the legality of his holding office, saying the merits of the allegation did not rise to a level of Texas Ranger investigative involvement. On November the 15th, Odessa Headlines publisher Jeff Russell filed a complaint with Ector County District Attorney Dustin Gallivan, stating state law prohibits Irvin from holding public office because he was arrested and convicted of delivery of dangerous drugs, cocaine, in 1976. Russell argued Irvin and public record searches have failed to turn up proof of the pardon Irvin said he has received. Texas Department of Public Records note Irvin's supervision status was discharged and he was granted clemency in January 1989. When Ervin applied for the ECUD board in 2016 and 2020, the form did not ask applicants if they had felony convictions, but the current form does. Galvin asked the Texas Rangers on November the 16th to determine if Ervin violated the criminal laws of Texas and stated if they determined he had, he would prosecute the case. On February 27th, Galvin received notice from Major Wayne Matthews of the Texas Rangers, who said the Rangers would not investigate. In addition, Matthews said he asked the Texas Attorney General's office to review the matter and that office, too, declined to investigate this matter. Thank you for the visibility and consideration regarding potential violations requiring your assistance, Matthews wrote in a letter to Galvin. Tuesday, Ervin said, "Is that cool or what? I'm glad that this part is over with. The folks that created this issue still have a lawsuit against me, and hopefully they'll get that over with and drop it pretty quick also." Last October, Will Capitfall and Troy Walker, two directors on the Ector County Utility District, along with local resident Jesse Taylor Christensen, filed a lawsuit against ECUD and three other directors in the hopes of having November's election halted. According to the lawsuit filed in Ector County District Court September the 28th, under state laws passed in the late 1990s, two cohorts of directors are supposed to be elected every other even year, and ECUD has failed to do so after 2002 and until 2016. The lawsuit alleges that in 2016, 2018, and 2020, the wrong people were put up for election, and the same thing was getting ready to happen in November. The lawsuit further alleges the Water Code has its own specific directive that elections are to take place in May of each even-numbered year. Kaufman asked an Ector County District Court judge to cancel November's election, but his motion was denied. Walker said Tuesday he has asked to be removed from the lawsuit, which remains pending. "It's a law that's on the books, but there's no teeth behind it. There's no one to enforce it," Walker said. "I don't think that going to court is going to have any positive outcome for the citizens of Ector County or ECUD's financials having to pay extra lawyers. I just felt like dropping the lawsuit was the right thing to do for the citizens of West Odessa." Ervin also said Tuesday his Austin attorney recently informed him an ombudsman with the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles has found boxes from 1987 through 1993 in a state building and is going through them in the hopes of finding his pardon paperwork. However, Ervin said he's spoken to several people who believe that if DPS has had that in their records, you can take it to the bank. School finance construction costs presented. A presentation of school finance and the cost of construction for schools were presented during an Ector County ISD Bond Advisory Committee meeting Monday. The meeting was held in the cafeteria of George H. W. Bush New Tech, Odessa. The next meeting will be at 6 p.m. on March 30th. There was also a presentation on career and technical education. Districts have two revenue streams of maintenance and operations and interest and sinking, or debt service. The total rate is $1.17 per $100 valuation. That includes $1.06 for maintenance and operations and 11 cents per $100 valuation for debt service. Financial Officer Deborah Otmers said it has been at that rate for 4 years. Otmers said education is expensive and very labor-intensive. Maintenance and operations includes teacher salaries, classroom supplies, utilities, and transportation. Debt service includes capital expenditures, land, building, construction, and renovations, and technology infrastructure. The debt service budget is about one-tenth the size of the maintenance and operations fund, she said. Most district funding comes from property taxes or state funding, Otmar said. The maximum the debt service tax can reach is 50 cents per $100 valuation. Otmar said bonds cannot be used to pay salaries. Funds collected can only be used for the repayment of debt, the annual principal and interest. The community authorizes the district to issue bonds through a bond referendum. The district receives the proceeds of the bond issue upfront, and the district pays off the debt over time with the revenue generated through the interest and sinking tax rate. Otmar said ECISD has about $16 billion in property value. The fund balance is not a savings account, but Otmar said if you want to think of it in those terms, you can. ECISD strives to keep 20 to 25% of its operating expenditures in the fund balance. The goal is to maintain that adequate level for those unforeseen costs that come up, Otmar said. Our healthy fund balance has allowed our bond rating to increase. Savings since 2020, Otmar said a total of $26.9 million has been paid in bond refinancing. As of now, Otmar said ECISD owes $107 million in principal and $27 million in interest for a total of $134,700,000. Otmar said they will pay that off in August 2037 or in 14 and a half years, according to their payment schedule. As for students that don't live in ECISD but go to school here, Otmar said they can get the same amount of money. Midland has some of ECISD kids too, she said. Superintendent Scott Murray said of 2021-22, 215 came into ECSID and 3,620 left. Left means left for charter, private school, to go to another district, or to be homeschooled, Murray said. This year, ECISD took in STEM Academy, so 700 students came in that were not here last year. About 1,200 of the students that left went to Compass Academy Charter School. Murray said 29 ECISD students went to Midland and 215 came to Ector County from Midland County. Daryl Pearson, partner and senior client executive with PBK Architects, said a big high school for 2,800 students cost $197,625,000 to $279 million. A middle school for 1,000 students cost $63,750,000 to $72,250,000. An elementary school for 750 students cost $37,400,000 to $42,900,000. These are construction costs, not total costs, and it includes an additional 25% in soft costs. According to buildexact.com, soft costs are all of the other expenses involved in a construction project that do not deal with the physical construction or process of construction. Most of these costs are for non-tangible items such as services, fees, and insurance, the website said. As for public versus charter school costs, Pearson said, if you dig through the drawings, what you'll normally find is sheetrock walls and not concrete masonry. Pearson said oftentimes charters have higher maintenance because of the methods and materials that cause it to be less expensive.
ORMC hosts famed Oregon Trail cyclists. Staff writer. Odessa Regional Medical Center will hold a news conference at 4:30 p.m. March 7th in the Permian Basin Kidney Center, 410 North Hancock Avenue, to celebrate National Kidney Month. The guest speaker and living kidney donor is Marge Scotch. Scotch, recipient of USA Today's Humankind Triumph of the Year Award, will speak at 4:30 p.m. Tuesday. Scotch, 67, is a living kidney donor and well known for his cycling journeys along the Oregon Trail. Scotch has made several cross-country trips since his kidney donation in 2020 and works to promote kidney health, living donor awareness, and post-donation functionality. We are very excited to have Mr. Scotch here with us, and Dr. Aman Reedy and Dr. Asif Ansari. March is National Kidney Month, and we still have no better way to spread awareness about the need for living kidney donors than having Mark here in Odessa. Scotch's fifth Oregon Trail will officially begin March 9th in Lubbock on World Kidney Day. He plans to bike 1,500 miles over the next 6 weeks, finally ending his journey in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Mark's wife, Lynn Scooch, will be in attendance as well. She became a living kidney donor in January. Reedy, director of the Permian Kidney Center, and Ansari, the center's consultant neurologist, said they hoped the event would raise awareness of kidney health and need for donors here in the Permian Basin. Approximately 3,000 new patients are added monthly to the national kidney waiting list, and 13 people die each day waiting for a kidney to become available. The Scotches said the hope their advocacy demonstrates to potential donors just how fulfilling life can be after donating an organ. The Oregon Trail is all about generating awareness of the need of kidney donors, especially living donors. But it's also about showing people that even with one kidney, you can still lead a life full of activities. Even those activities are sustained and vigorous, Mark Scooch said. The press conference will be held in the Permian Basin Kidney Center parking lot. For more information, visit markscooch.com. Literacy Coalition of the Permian Basin hosts Perryman. Staff writer, Carlsbad, New Mexico. The Literary Coalition of the Permian Basin and the Carlsbad Community Foundation will host the Eddy County Literacy Conversation from noon to 1:30 p.m. Monday at the Walter Garrell Center Annex, 4012 National Parks Highway. The event will discuss the economic impact of literacy and how it affects the local workforce. John Tricchetti, Executive Director of LCPB, is a guest presenter that will be engaging the audience with an interactive poll regarding literacy. The recent study by the American Institute of Research measured the literacy deficits of the region. The study reveals that over one-third of adults in the Permian Basin read at or below third-grade level. In some countries in our area, that number climbs to 50%. The Literacy Coalition of the Permian Basin is working on behalf of our community to increase awareness of our regional literacy deficits and address those needs by building the capacity of local nonprofits and other institutes serving low-literate individuals. The Literary Coalition of the Permian Basin does that through sub-granting, collaborations, training opportunities, and advocacy. McCoy's Building Architect, inspired by Big Bend Landscape. Alpine. The new Emmett and Miriam McCoy's Building at the Museum of Big Bend on Sorrel State University's Alpine campus was drawn and planned by Senior Principal Architect Lawrence W. Speck, FAIA. Speck earned his Master Architect from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, as well as a multiple of honors and awards in design and education. He led significant architectural projects, including the Austin Convention Center, Discovery Green Park, Houston, the Austin Bergstrom International Airport, and many more. He has also been profiled and mentioned in the Atlantic, the New York Times, and Texas Monthly, among architectural publications in the U.S. internationally. Speck attributes much of his ideas to the surrounding area. The most significant inspiration for this project is the landscape of the Big Bend region, he said. With its long, low sloping roof, its solid, compact volume, and its rugged weathering materials, the building recalls both the topography and the texture of the surrounding geography. In my mind, this building cannot be anywhere except in this locale. Speck explained that the building is shaped to take fully the views of the mountains and other landscape features. Circular indentions in the indoor event and workspaces, with properly placed windows, all for the vistas to be carefully displayed. In addition to the unique panoramic environment, Speck cited the museum building itself as a source of inspiration. The arch windows would become a prominent feature of the new visitor's entry and be the focal point of the views in the event space, he said. The university itself also figured its planning, largely due to existing plans for improved pedestrian facilities. Of course, creating an environment that would greatly enhance the visitor's experience of the museum, exhibits, and collections was also a paramount factor in the building's design. The two discrete galleries will provide a much-needed non-distractive space for art that was a scale that simply will allow the art to really sing, he said. Complete control of the lighting, humidity, and other environmental factors will provide a great deal of flexibility in exhibiting borrowed and changing exhibits. The more casual display spaces in the concourse have natural light and a dynamic grand feeling. That central concourse space is probably my favorite part of the building. For more information, visit museumofthebigbend.com. Scherlinger Program produces third legacy class entry in 4 days. Athens, Ohio. Ivy was back at it again on Monday with his third legacy class fish submitted by an angler in 4 days. Melita Criswell of Hobbs, New Mexico, landed her catch of a lifetime with a 14.08-pound Scherlinger, 646. Criswell is the first female angler of the 2023 Toyota Scherlinger collection season to reel in legacy class lunker. This also marks the second year in a row that a female angler donated their fish to the Scherlinger program. Kelly Renfro of Lufkin was the first since 2018 to catch a legacy class lunker when she boated 13.27-pound Scherlinger, 628, on March 10, 2022 at Lake Nacogdoches. Criswell's catch boasted OHIV's seasonal total to 12, matching the lake's output from 2021 and 2022 season. Lake Allen Henry and Nacogdoches are the other two water bodies with legacy class entries this year. Their contributions put overall tally at 14 heading into the first and final month of the collection season. It has been great to see the momentum of legacy lunkers continue through the month of February, said Natalie Goldstrom, Toyota Scherlinger Program Coordinator. It has been impressive to see 12 legacy class lunkers produced from OHIV in just 2 months. It will be exciting to see how many are produced during the final months of the collection period. Criswell used to fish offshore in Cabo San Lucas, but also had her own bass boat for 3 years. She began using her husband's 16-foot John boat to troll Oak Creek Reservoir to fish a few years ago, where they owned some property. I just love and have been fascinated with fishing my whole life, said Criswell. I caught white bass, catfish, and crappie, and then I started catching largemouth bass. I'm getting more interested in largemouth bass, and before I knew it, I was standing in the boat drifting, casting for bass. Bob Dennis, my boat mechanic, said he really taught me how to bass fish. 4 years ago, on my birthday, he gave me some spinner bait and told me to learn how to use a bait caster. Once he told me, he took me fishing and taught me old school, how to reach the land, how to visualize, and I started catching bass, so I went in and got a bass boat. Criswell drives to Texas every Friday to fish for the weekend. Last weekend, she participated in her first bass tournament and won it. Along with catching the biggest bass of the tournament, Criswell read about the Scherlinger program last year and made a goal to be a part of it. Fast forward to Monday when her dream of catching a Scherlinger became a reality. I went out fishing with Brady Stanford, and then the wind was terrible to start out, said Criswell. We had to fish according to the weather, so I was using a deep dive crankbait and caught a 7-pound fish. There were some other big ones, and I tried a lot of different things, but they just wouldn't react. Criswell said they weren't ready to give up, so they went back to a few spots. I was using an A-rig and initially threw at and missed the fish, who was by itself a 15 to 20 foot of water, said Criswell. I let Brady give it a try, and he did fish, didn't take a bait either. However, I cast again and she attacked it. I did everything in my power not to scream with excitement. Once the fish was in the boat, Criswell made the call to the Scherlinger program and headed to Concho to get the official weight for entry into the program. My experience with the program was phenomenal, said Criswell. I learned a lot from Brady and, of course, TPWD staff and how to take care of the fish. TPWD does an excellent job. I know the fish is going to a spa haven. It's really neat to see the whole process firsthand. I hope this encourages anybody to go out and try to chase their dreams, because my dream last year was to catch a Scherlinger, and I did it. I've had wonderful support from my many people and my husband on the journey. I'm very grateful for the opportunity to share in this.
A different perspective. OCA students correspond with Ukrainian students. The story was written by Ruth Campbell. Students in Michael Crowder's World Geography class are getting some first-hand knowledge of the subject, along with current events, through a pen pal program with students in Odessa, Ukraine. Crowder has 120 students, and most of them have been matched with students at several high schools in Odessa, Ukraine. The program came about through the district's social studies coordinator, Becky Ramirez. She brought the idea to Crowder toward the middle of fall last year and said it is something the district wanted to do. Crowder started getting his students signed up for it just before Christmas break. Chris Mead, who is in Virginia, acted as a go-between on setting the program up. He started matching up the different groups of students that would sign up from here and pairing them with students in Ukraine. Once the students got their email contacts, they started corresponding back and forth, although it has been kind of spotty at times due to the war with Russia. Quote, "So far, the kids have responded pretty well. I've gotten quite a few kids that hear back and forth from their pen pals. We've got some who, unfortunately, the contact isn't as frequent. It was like I remind the kids, they may be without power. Those kids may be without services there. There's a war going on, and so when you tell them that kind of stuff, the kids understand," Crowder said. He added that it has broadened the students' horizons. Quote, "The ones that hear back frequently, they talk a lot about how things are very different for the kids over there. But then it's the other comment that I've heard from them multiple times from my students is, they're not all that different. They're just like me. They're just going through other stuff," Crowder said. He's not sure the program will continue next year. Quote, "It's really kind of just depends on what pairings we have and how things match up and what students are available in Ukraine and how much the district and Mr. Mead want to continue," Crowder said. Joaquin Carrasco, a 15-year-old ninth grader, and Cade Clay, a 14-year-old freshman, have corresponded with students in Ukraine. Quote, "I thought it was pretty interesting to see how it was in a different place besides here in Odessa," Carrasco said. He said he's been able to get in touch with his pen pal fairly frequently, but other times it takes a while. He said they talk about how school is going and not so much about the war. Carrasco said his pen pal has been able to attend school, and last time he corresponded with him, he was studying for a test. What surprised him was how similar things are. Quote, "I thought it was going to be different, but I guess there are a lot of similarities," Carrasco said. Cade said it was cool being able to talk to someone you normally wouldn't be able to. He asks his pen pal about what's happening, but he hasn't said much. He added that it has widened his horizons to think about what's going on in other places, but getting insight from someone like himself has opened his eyes. Principal James Ramage says the pen pal program is really unique. Quote, "It's with our freshmen, so it's our youngest kids here. A lot of times, freshmen don't think outside their world, really. They're 14, 15-year-old kids, and now they're hearing from students across the world in Ukraine who face a completely different dynamic of sometimes they don't have power. Sometimes they don't have internet. Sometimes they don't go to school because they can't. That's something that our kids have never considered ever before because those things aren't happening here in the U.S. It's really interesting to hear their perspective of, wow, this person I'm talking to in Ukraine is going through a whole different ordeal than I can ever imagine," Ramage said. "I think there's a lot of empathy of what's happening outside our world here in Odessa, Texas, he added.
Pioneer Natural says 2022 record year. Long lateral drilling initiatives to continue by Bob Campbell. Pioneer Natural Resources marked its fifth straight year of drilling and completion efficiency gains and generated $8.4 billion in free cash flow in 2022. Chief Executive Officer Scott Sheffield said in Pioneer's fourth quarter earnings report, February 23rd, that his company also has a record production year. Strengthening our fortress-like balance sheet and remaining disciplined with a reinvestment rate of 30% of our cash flow, we remain highly constructive of oil prices, Sheffield said. I'm still very optimistic that we'll move back to that $90 to $100 range. The company plans to deliver a 2023 full-year reduction ranging from 357,000 to 372,000 barrels of oil per day, and total production ranging from 370,000 to 700,000 per day. Sheffield said key projects will include the exploration drilling of four wells targeting the Barnett and Woodford formations in the Midland area. We expect the generation greater than $4 billion of free cash flow in 2023 from approximately $9 billion of projected operating cash flow, he said. Throughout 2023, we will operate between 24 and 26 drilling rigs. The continuous nature of our acreage position provides multiple operational benefits, including drilling and completing 15,000-foot-plus lateral. Our lateral link developments delivered strong productivity and increased returns when compared to a 10-foot lateral well. Drilling and completing these long lateral drives significant efficiency gains that reduce capital costs for drilling and completion savings of 15% on a cost per lateral foot basis, Sheffield said. To date, we're identified more than 1,000 locations for long lateral development, and we expect more than 100 of these wells to be placed on production in 2023. The CEO said Irving-based company will also benefit from the continued utilization of Stimulfrac operations and will reduce costs by $200,000 per well. The implementation of a similar Stimulfrac completions is a major contribution to our efficiency improvements and cost saving over the last couple of years, he said. We continue to build on that success with the deployment of a third full-time Stimulfrac fleet during this quarter. President Chief Operating Officer Rich Dealey said the climate risk reports that Pioneer published in 2022 highlighted our focus as significant progress on environmental, social, and governance initiatives and their impact on our businesses. We believe these actions demonstrate your commitment and focus on ESG and further strengthen Pioneer's position as a leader in the industry, Dealey said. We continue to provide low-emission barrels to the market and produce some of the most sustainable barrels in the world, beyond Norway CO2 intensity basis. When combined with our low break, even oil price, Pioneer provides essentially resilient production and will expect to have a place in the global market for decades to come.
Dear Dr. Roach, I'm an 82-year-old, very healthy woman. In February 2020, just as the COVID-19 pandemic was starting to appear in North America, I had a viral infection that was relatively mild, a bit of coughing, runny nose, itchy throat, and lasted for a few days only, although I felt tired for a bit longer. One unusual symptom was that I lost my sense of taste and smell. At that time, it was not known that COVID-19 caused this in many people, nor did we have tests to determine if I had COVID-19. I've tried to stimulate my sense of smell by smelling perfumes that I like, cinnamon or anything that has a strong smell, but this has not resulted in a reappearance of the sense of smell. As someone who enjoys cooking, it's very disconcerting to remember how the house smelled, sometimes for days after cooking certain dishes, and now I can't smell it at all. This makes me very sad. Dr. Roach's answer. I cannot say for certain whether that initial infection was COVID-19 or some other virus, but during that time, the dominant infection was certainly SARS-CoV-2, and the loss of sense of smell is so characteristic of the virus at that time that it is hard to believe the blood testing you had. Blood tests are not perfect. Studies on people who lost their sense of smell due to COVID show that 96% of people recovered sense of smell by 8 months. I don't know of any data that show what happened to the 4% of people who didn't. And while I agree with the ENT doctor who said it was possible that your sense of smell could return, I have never seen a person who lost their sense of smell for as long as you have had it returned.
This is the Dear Abby column. Woman's lies and sexting put marriage on the brink. Dear Abby, I found out today that my wife was sexting with a man in another state. His girlfriend sent me a message which included a series of screenshots. I had confronted my wife regarding this prior to receiving the messages, but she swore she had only sent one topless photo and nothing else. After I reviewed the messages, I saw much more. She claims she doesn't remember everything, which I find hard to believe. Worse, they had planned to meet. She claims she didn't, but I saw a message saying that once I went back home, we were visiting her parents, she would stay an extra week with our son so he could spend more time with his grandparents, and she could maneuver to meet up with him. She claims she didn't, but I can't believe her based on her lying repeatedly about this. We have a child together, so I don't want to walk away, but I'm deeply hurt and no longer trust her. I know you will recommend marriage counseling, but beyond that process, is there anything I should do? Signed, Lost in the East. Dear Lost, has your wife always been this way, or is this behavior something new? She seems to be severely allergic to the truth. By all means, attempt marriage counseling if she is willing. However, if she isn't willing, have some counseling without her. And start interviewing attorneys to represent you in what is likely to be a divorce. Without trust, there can be no marriage. P.S. Save those messages and images the girlfriend sent you, because they could come in handy. Dear Abby, I'm 59 and the oldest of four children. When we were kids, our parents were raging alcoholics. They smoked pot and were barely functioning adults. As the oldest, I was tasked with caring for and raising the other three, which I did to protect them from my parents' nonsense. We were never close to our parents. Our father passed away some years ago, which left our mom, who continued to live her booze-filled life. She was a terrible mother. She never protected us from my father's verbal and physical abuse. My brother still has nightmares about him. Now that our mother has dementia, my siblings make a lot of effort to spend time with her. I refuse to have anything to do with her. My sisters say I should make amends because she won't live forever. I have made my peace with it all, and I'm fine without what I never had. My siblings think I should just get over it because she can't remember anything. Because she can't remember doesn't negate the fact that it happened. I've had a fantastic life and family without her being part of it. I'm truly happy. Am I wrong for standing strong in my decision? Signed, Resolute in Florida. Dear Resolute, because your mother can no longer remember what a failure she was as a parent, doesn't mean you must magically forget. She has reached a point where she is beyond any help you can give her. Now, it's time to take care of yourself. If you feel it's better to stand strong on your decision, do not allow yourself to be guilted into doing otherwise. You can write to Dear Abby at dearabby.com or P.O. Box 69440, Los Angeles, California, 9069. Her column is distributed by Universal Press Syndicate.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.